Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week, the Lee Swim takes place this weekend and celebrates its centenary. Norman Freeman on Going on the Rocks in Scandinavia. We've the second part of our conversation with author John Tullier on his book Kinsale Harbour, A History, and you can still enter our Seascapes competition. The Royal St. George Yacht Club plays host to the European Optimist Championships. First, this week on your maritime programme, to the recent Round Ireland yacht race from Wicklow Sailing Club. 36 yachts departed Wicklow Bay for the 18th sailing of the Round Ireland yacht race. The first yacht across the line was the largest in the fleet, the Volvo 70 Monster Project, with Wicklow farmer David Ryan at the helm. A large crowd turned out to welcome David home. We'll hear from some of those who completed the race from Wicklow Sailing Club. First, the voice of Peter Shearer, Commodore of the club.
There was a super crowd down at the end of the pier, lots of sailing people, but lots of local people from the town. One of the biggest receptions we've had at a Round Ireland finish. To see David in Monster Project, that beautiful Volvo 70, coming down, crossing the line, big cheer, and then turning around and doing a beautiful sail past, a gentle sail past under main, was really fantastic. We're absolutely delighted. The Round Ireland is really special to us. It was started by a group in 1980, a group of people who really kind of thought something different, let's try and organise something different. And we've run it every 2 years since then. And for us to run the Round Ireland takes a huge amount of effort, a huge amount of voluntary work from virtually all the club members. We're so proud of the fact that we get great boats coming to do it. We're so proud of the fact that the same boats come back again and again. They obviously like what we offer them. For the 2016, we have a start date, 18th June. We are planning it already. We're working with RIYC and Dunleary. What we're going to do now is actually launch a pretty aggressive campaign to bring back a big sponsor. There is huge potential in this race, and we really want to try and grow the race to make it into such a race that people say, the Fastnet, yeah, I know that one. The Round Ireland, yeah, I know that one. These are brilliant races. These are races that sailors want to do.
The start was quite good. Plenty of air down the east coast. We're doing 23 knots. It was a real buzz. Flat sea, 23 knots. Then it died off on the south coast and up along by the Skelligs. We were actually holding off other boats, trying to hold the racing line. It was heavy going. I had no concept really of the toughness of the race, and it became apparent when the airs became very light. I have nothing but the height of admiration for people that would spend a month on that boat. The wind got up to 29 knots at one stage, and we blew out a sail on the way down. Well, a lead is a cushion. Never take anything for granted. Actually come over the line. It was very emotional for me that so many people took time to come down, and there's such goodwill behind our effort. We started out with saying, you know, I'm thrilled for myself, the team, and for anybody that has given us any support in any way. My wife was proud of me. She knows that I don't have huge sailing experience, and I've pulled it off. Doing the Round Ireland race is an adventure of a lifetime. And if you have a dream to do it, go and do it, whatever it takes, because you won't be disappointed.
It looks like we came in second overall and maybe first in class, but it was very close. We had a very frustrating couple of hours where we sailed into a hole and just couldn't get our way out of it, so we lost some time there. But I think everybody probably had the same experience elsewhere on the race course, so that everything evens out. The high is finishing, absolutely, getting it done. Getting to know a group of people like the crew is very special. Watching whales breach off the Fastnet, extraordinary, fantastic memories from the race. But not to be done too often. I'm going to have a pint. I'm going to sit in my sitting room, away from boats and water, for a good 6 months.
To try this type of event, I think they've really got to try and start being crewing on boats that have can get you start crewing on boats where you get the experience. You got to do the starting your overnight racing, and then that's where it kind of stems from where tan it comes from. We used to do a lot of offshore racing up in Glasgow, and that's obviously stems us to now doing from doing Fastnets to doing Sydney Hobarts. But if anyone wants to have a go at it, yeah, try and get on a boat. There's plenty of boats always looking, even at the start of this round island, there were boats still looking for crew. Maybe you'd be lucky enough to get yourself on a boat and go around, race around Ireland.
Sailing it's not an elite sport. It's an elite sport to own a yacht. There's a big expense to crewing a yacht. Every yacht in the country really wants someone to crew in their boat. I myself, I'm a commodore of our local yacht club in Loughswilly Yacht Club, and we are always crying out for people to come to sail, to try out sailing, to come and crew in boats. But in terms of offshore sailing, you love it or you hate it. If you like to spend some time in a boat, it's good. In terms of offshore racing, the Round Ireland Yacht Race is a pinnacle of the offshore yacht racing calendar, and it's local to us. So anyone that has any fancy to spend any time in a yacht, then come to the Round Ireland Yacht Race. You will not get better than this.
The race winner was Tannet, and we heard the voice there of Commodore of Loughswilly Yacht Club and former Clipper skipper Richie Fearon from Fahan, who was Tactics and Navigation Specialist aboard the Scottish Entry. Our thanks to Emily Cox for that audio from the Round Ireland Yacht Race. A recent visitor to these shores was the Sea Education Association when they hosted a One Ocean event to coincide with the visit of the American Marine Research Tall ship, the SSV Corwith Cramer, from Woods Hole in Massachusetts. Speakers included Dr. Valerie Cummins of the Irish Maritime and Energy Resource Cluster, IMERC, marine biologist Dr. Tom Doyle of Beaufort Research, Captain Elliot Rappaport, Associate Professor of Nautical Science, and Dr. Paul Joyce, Dean of SEA. We talked to Peg Brandon, President of Sea Education Association.
Well, Sea Education Association is delighted to be in Cork. We've just arrived, as you know, from a 25-day crossing from Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And our business is the ocean and introducing college students from all over the world to learning about the oceans. And it's particularly fabulous to arrive here after crossing because the same ocean that washes up on the Woods Hole beaches is the one that's right here on the River Lee. And it's the same one that's out in Polynesia and so on. So we've got one global ocean here, and it's important that we all work together to find out as much as we can, because it impacts all of us, whether it's the environmental challenges that we all face of debris in the ocean or climate change or carbon sequestering. We need to find out some of these answers because we need to face these common challenges together. We need to heighten our awareness of how we're all participating in this, and so that we can make wiser choices going forward, because it's the health of all of us that's at risk.
Of course, a working vessel like this, as was pointed out by Elliot Rappaport earlier, who's about to take over the captainship, is the fact that the students aboard learn great seafaring skills, and there's nothing better really in terms of a life skill.
Exactly. If we want to solve the challenges that we all face, climate change, what have you, fisheries, degradation, you name it, you need to not only know about the science, but you need to be able to work and collaborate with other people. So if we look at the example of the Corwith Cramer, this beautiful brigantine, it takes a team to make that ship go, to get it across the Atlantic, to do the oceanographic work that we're doing. And the students are learning just not only the science, but also the leadership and the teamwork that's required to make that successful. This is the Corwith Cramer, and it's been Atlantic-based since we built it in 1988. But in the Pacific, currently leaving Hawaii and bound for American Samoa, is the Robert C. Seaman, with another class of students on board from around the world, and they're out there exploring what's going on in the sister ocean out there, the Pacific. The ship is working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and all the students have a full role in the part of the scientific team as well as the ship's crew. So if you show up on board at midnight, you're going to find students in the lab, students steering the ship, navigating, making breakfast. It's going on 24/7. The 25 students that left Woods Hole on board the Corwith Cramer and arrived here in Cork last week, they have moved on, some of them to stay in Ireland, others to fly back home. But on the 6th, we have an entire new class flying here into Cork to join the Cramer, and they'll be departing Cork on the 6th and bound for France and Portugal and into the Mediterranean. I always wanted to sail around the world with Jacques Cousteau, so I was inspired by National Geographic and the idea of exploring and adventuring and learning. And while I didn't exactly ever meet Jacques Cousteau, I certainly feel as though I've been able to accomplish that in my career through working with these ships, bringing students out to sea. We're all exploring our ocean world and getting a better understanding. And today we're talking about the leatherback sea turtles that come here to that coast of Ireland. You know, and turtles are a good example because they are ocean travelers. The work that Tom Doyle's been doing showed us that in order to find their preferred jellyfish and other cool creatures, they sail across the Atlantic just like the Corwith Cramer did. So I think the sea turtle, the leatherback sea turtle that comes here to the Irish coast is just as good a creature as any other. So we all know the ocean is 70% of our planet's surface and so important to all of us. So we know more about the surface of Mars than we do about the ocean floor. So we've got a lot of work cut out for us here to discover this frontier right at our doorstep.
Our thanks to the United States Embassy, and you can see and read more about the Corwith Cramer and the work of the Sea Education Association in Woods Hole on www.sea.edu. Next here on Seascapes, to the second instalment in our conversation with John Tullier, author of Kinsale Harbour, A History, just published by the Collins Press. We talked about the decline of the port, which was critical by 1922.
So we touched very briefly on the fact that Kinsale consists of, it's a sheltered harbour. It's a sheltered harbour because it actually has three harbours. We know we referred to the outer harbour, the middle harbour and the inner harbour. And as well as that, it has this great natural barrier extending 5 miles out into the sea of the old head of Kinsale. You know, protection from the prevailing winds. For ships up to the 1750s, Kinsale was ideal in that it had enough water for the ships that sailed the oceans up to that particular time. It also has great advantages in terms of the fact, again, back to the old head, a very identifiable landfall. The prevailing winds mean that you have contact in a sailing reaching situations of direct with France and Spain. You just turn around and go on the other reach on the way back. A massive hinterland of the Bandon River. All of these generated this visitors, various waves of settlers into Kinsale, all coming by boat. Now, one of the things we've spoken about already was the fisheries aspect of it. And that started around 1860. And it was the catalyst. There were actually two retired Coast Guard men, fishermen, and they engaged in fishing. They were from the Isle of Man originally themselves. And after the second, being very successful the first year themselves, they attracted Manx boats in subsequent years, which were done for the 30 years or so like that, up to about 1900, 1910, 1912. And then all of a sudden, the fisheries declined. In fact, the fish, the mackerel, the spring mackerel in particular, migrated further west, and Baltimore took over at that particular point with the advantage of having the rail line, for instance, going all the way down to the pier, as distinct from Kinsale, where it was up in the hill. But the point is that it was a frightful period for Kinsale. The town was absolutely devastated. It was devastated because those engaged in the fishing no longer came to Kinsale, and all the service and resources that had been built up for the 30 years prior to that were left to decline into dereliction and so on. For 40 years subsequent to that, from 1920s up to about the 1960s, Kinsale, I mean, in my younger days, I heard of people, the level of immigration, for instance, of young people leaving to go to work in England, to go to sea, sailing under foreign flags, was absolutely devastating. And then in the 1950s or so, another catalyst in the way of an individual, Gary Culhan, an Irishman, and his sister, Peggy Green, arrived in Kinsale and saw the potential of the harbour in terms of deep sea angling, the recreational aspect of it. And they, in a very, with huge energy and tremendous foresight and vision, established this, the angling centre in Kinsale. They're skippers, they're hiring in skippers, men who had spent their lives at sea, men who, Kinsale men who had spent their lives at sea, full of the tradition and the knowledge and skills that people reared in Kinsale had. And as a result, brought in hundreds of Dutch and German, I remember in particular, and English, yearly into go angling. Almost immediately, you had what was the old dockyard became a hotel, originally built by the Rank organisation, the Film People, and is now known as the Trident Hotel. Bed and breakfast boomed, restaurants there to feed the people and so on. And in that way, as a result of recognising the potential in the seas of Kinsale, this whole phenomenon of tourism, for which Kinsale now has become noted, developed. The quantities of cargo that could be carried in ships, no, it was very slow and it was very dependent on the wind and tides and so on like that, but it was amazing. And there you had this commerce, this commercial traffic up and down the river, as you say, as far as places like Collier's Quay, up at Chipool, and on further to Inishannon, and even further before the great earthquake, the Lisbon earthquake of 1754, up as far as Briny, for instance, where the Briny River meets the Bandon. Yes, not alone that, but you also had what was known as the sand keys. There's a series of the remains of these little sand keys are still left, where, you know, the local farmers, the local, perhaps the tower house owners, the mill owners, whoever, had access again to the water. But also they're called sand keys because of the sand that was removed from Kinsale Harbour, brought up river and used as fertiliser. The lime content of the sand from the harbour, of course, provided great fertiliser quality to the manure that was put on the land. You know, but many other things, of course. Bandon then being an industrial area, it actually had representation on Kinsale Harbour Board for many, many years. So it was really the Kinsale Harbour Board was Kinsale and Bandon Harbour Board, having meetings maybe two or three times a year at Kilmacsimon and to discuss the activities on the river. At the moment, the whole tourism industry is absolutely booming in Kinsale, but one must consider, I think, that there is nothing worse than going on your holidays to a tourist resort. You know, the banality, the level of interest declines if you have nothing but provision for the tourist. And the tourist doesn't want it either. I mean, the tourist is interested in shipping, is interested in the activities that are indigenous to the community in anywhere you visit. I mean, you want to go and see and touch it. Now, we don't want to turn Kinsale into a museum either, but I think we need to be extremely careful that we do not overdo the what I describe as the sort of polite harbour, the polite waterfront and so on. What is more interesting than coming down and seeing a ship coming alongside, even the pure operation of berthing a ship, the you know, to go around to the stern and look at the port of registration, and no reason why information couldn't be provided for the public as to what is she discharging, where she come from, the type of thing that you get in the modern sort of navigation equipment now, why that couldn't be actually on display. It would enhance the situation. Similarly with the fishing. There's no reason why the fishing activity should in any way interfere with people coming to sea and just adding the interest. Now, I think the fishermen have a responsibility and the ship owners have a responsibility to keep things clean and tidy, and that there are other users and they must also be considered. And I'm absolutely fascinated recently in going to visiting Padstow, the North Cornish coast, and there access to the sea is not possible. So for 4 hours in every tide, every 12 hours, you have the barrier is lowered and you can get in and out to the camber. And yet there they have tourism beautifully integrated with the fishing industry, an active fishing industry. And there's no conflict. I mean, there's no apparent conflict, at least. There's no reason why in a place like Kinsale one cannot borrow from the other and support one another. And I think in that way, the tourism industry will continue. Kinsale will maintain its integrity as a port in its truest, fullest sense. That change will not be as catastrophic as it was in the past. I mean, the decline. I, as a young person growing up in Kinsale, remember the absolute deprivation, you know, the real poverty that existed among the people. Today, as a result of the tourism industry, Kinsale is a very prosperous town. But it can change, and change very suddenly.
The voice of John Tullier, author of Kinsale Harbour, A History, published by the Collins Press. We have several copies of the book in our Seascapes competition. We want you to tell us on what site was the Royal Dockyard in Kinsale. In other words, where there is now a hotel. Just name the hotel which has a maritime theme. Answers on a postcard to Seascapes, RTE Radio 1, Father Matthew Street in Cork, or by email seascapes@rte.ie. To Scandinavian waters next here on Seascapes, and this tale from writer and broadcaster Norman Freeman and his adventure from the 60s.
Going on the rocks can happen in the most unexpected ways. In August 1963, our cargo ship, the Wairangi of the Shaw Savile Line, reached the outskirts of Stockholm. It was the end of a long voyage from South America and Europe. We felt that we had reached journey's end. The pilot came on board about midnight. After I shut the radio room, I went up to the bridge to watch him taking our ship through the tortuous waterway, with its many navigation beacons blinking in the darkness. He kept calling out to the man at the wheel, 2 degrees port, 2 degrees starboard, 1 degree port. His voice had a monotonous effect. I was sound asleep in my bunk about 2 a.m. when I was woken by a great shaking movement. The ship groaned and shuddered. The engine seemed to go astern and then stopped. Then the alarm bells echoed all along the passageways. I raced up to the radio room. The second mate dashed in to tell me that we had gone on an outcrop of rocks called Klovholmen. He gave me the ship's position. "There's a danger she may break her back," he called as he hurried out the door. The pilot was already talking to the port authorities in Stockholm on the very high frequency radio, but I had to alert the Swedish marine radio stations on medium wave. While I was hammering away on the Morse key, I noticed a calendar on the bulkhead swinging sideways. Then a pencil rolled across the desk that was beginning to slope. Next thing I heard shouts of command, and then came the rattling sound of the davits as the lifeboats were being lowered. Afterwards I heard what had happened. The Swedish pilot had kept calling out the changes of course to the able seaman on the wheel. So many degrees to starboard, so many port, back and forward, on and on and on. It seems the wheelsman lost concentration just at the end of his watch. He went to starboard instead of to port. The pilot shouted out to him, but it was too late. We crunched onto the rocks. Before dawn broke, 2 Swedish tugboats and 2 large rescue vessels had arrived and were standing by. It was reckoned that there was no danger of our ship breaking her back, and at mid-morning the lifeboats and those in them were lifted up. Despite several efforts by the Swedish tugs to pull us free, with the ship's engines going full astern, we remained pinioned on those rocks. After 5 or 6 days stuck there, our salvation appeared in the form of an enormous tugboat from the world's most famous salvage operation, Smits of Rotterdam. It was, most fittingly, called Goliath. Everyone on board was on standby as the hardy Dutchmen put big steel cables around us. At a given word, our engines were put full astern. The thunder of Goliath's engines could be heard for miles around. The water churned white. Then suddenly we felt our ship slide back into the water. There was a collective sigh of relief that we were afloat once again. Accompanied by Goliath and 2 Swedish tugs, we made our way slowly up to Stockholm. There our wounded ship was put into dry dock. When the water drained out, we went down to view the damage. It was as if a massive tin opener had ripped an enormous gash along the underside of our ship. It was no surprise to hear that the vessel was considered a write-off. Our captain, Derek Aberdeen, a very fine man, said, "Well, from now on the phrase, going on the rocks, will mean something to us all."
Going on the Rocks with Norman Freeman, author of Sea Spray and Whiskey. The National Coarse Fishing Federation of Ireland are hosting the 4th World Feeder Fishing Championships on Inniscarra Reservoir near the village of Coachford on the 19th and 20th of this month. That's next weekend. You can read and see more on www.ncffi.ie. As we mentioned earlier, the annual Vibes and Scribes Lee Swim takes place this weekend, celebrating its centenary and featuring Seven Oceans open water swimmer Steve Redmond, amongst others. We wish all those taking part all the best. Next week here on Seascapes, the remarkable story of the Winifreda, built in Hall Boland in the 1890s by the Royal Navy to carry gunpowder from Rocky Island magazine and purchased by the Villiers Stewart family in 1917. The vessel is being sailed in Irish waters by Gary Villiers Stewart. We'll be at the European Optimist Championships and we'll have a report from the Royal St George Yacht Club in Dunleary, plus Hugh Oram on the Enrights of Castleconnell. All that and much more until next Friday night. Tight lines and fair sailing.